The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. It's a pleasure to have him return, even without slides. Please welcome Reza Aslan.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do? Technical difficulties. At least I get to walk around a little bit. I did have a very nice slide presentation for you, but that's okay. We'll just have a conversation. And then I know there's probably a lot of you have a lot of thoughts about what's going on right now. In Iran, ever since the death of an Iranian Kurdish woman named Mahsa Amini, the entire country has been aflame. And what we're seeing is protests erupting, not just in the sort of urbanized areas in Tehran or Isfahan or the major cities, but we're seeing protests that are now erupting in a majority of the provinces across the country. I have gone on record calling this a revolution, not an uprising. I have very specific reasons for why I call it that. Some of you may know that Iran has had three major revolutions of the 20th century, and I think that this is shaping up to become the fourth revolution. Why do I say that? Well, because the difference between an uprising, or maybe what I should say instead, is that what elevates an uprising, of which Iran has had hundreds in the last 40 years. In fact, there have been dozens of uprisings in the last 6 months taking place with factory workers and farm workers and retirees and teachers who've been protesting the deteriorating economic conditions in Iran. This is long before the murder of Mahsa Amini. But what elevates an uprising into a revolution, I think, is twofold. Number one, it involves a broad coalition of people. You know, a number of people have talked about how what we're seeing today reminds them a little bit of the Green Movement in 2009, and I understand why people would say that, but these two things could not be more different. The Green Movement of 2009 was a mostly peaceful demonstration and march, and it was almost exclusively young, middle-class, educated, urbanized youth. Part of the reason why that movement, quote-unquote, failed had largely to do with the fact that it never appealed beyond that sort of constituency that I just referred to. And the key to a successful revolution is, can you broaden your coalition? Can you pull disparate groups together in order to create a large umbrella? And yes, you may all have different grievances. You may even have different ideas for what should come after the downfall of the government. But nevertheless, the ability to put aside those differences and unite together as a single force is what elevates a popular protest or an uprising or demonstrations to the level of revolution. And that's exactly what we've been watching happen over the last 4 weeks. It's absolutely 100% correct to refer to this as a women's-led revolution. And it is. It is absolutely a women's-led revolution. It is a revolution that was sparked by the death of a woman, and it is a revolution that is being led primarily by women. However, what we've been seeing over the last 3 weeks is men joining this cause, older generations coming in onto the streets, regime supporters, conservatives, pious masses. We're literally watching women dressed head to toe, covered in chador, the sort of traditional, very conservative Islamic dress, standing next to teenage women wearing jeans and t-shirts and without a veil. Both of them chanting, not for reform, not complaining about the economic situation, but very clearly and as explicitly as possible, calling for the downfall of the regime, the government itself. When that starts to happen, now you know you've got that coalition. You've reached out to different sectors of society. The second thing that's very important is to build a coalition with the business community. And that's really how the 1906 and 1953 and 1979 revolutions succeeded, is that they were able to get the merchant class, the unions, the guilds, to actually join the revolution and call for economic boycotts and economic strikes. And over the last week, what we have seen is the oil sector workers going on strike. We're seeing the Bazaari merchants closing down their shops, threatening the government that if they don't stop the violent crackdown on these innocent people on the streets, that they will continue to make the economy suffer. And understand that the economy of Iran is already on the verge of collapse anyway. And then the third aspect of this is, can it be nationwide, or is it just the major cities, right? If it's just in the major cities, it can be ignored as demonstrations or protests or uprisings. And what we are seeing now is that this movement is, by the reporting that we're seeing coming out of Iran, in a majority of the provinces in Iran. 19 of the 31 provinces have reported mass demonstrations over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And even in very conservative provinces, a couple of days ago, there was a massive protest in the city of Qom. And if you know anything about Iran, Qom is the Vatican of Shiism in Iran. It is the holy city. It's sort of the home base for the clerical regime. And to see people in that city coming out by the thousands, again, not calling for reform, but saying death to the dictator, death to Khamenei, in Khamenei's backyard, is truly extraordinary. And I guess what I want to do today is talk to you about how this movement right now and this call for the most basic of human rights, the ability to just simply have a say in the decisions that rule your life, right? That's about as basic of a request as it gets. How this movement has its roots in the first revolution in Iran in 1906, and how a 22-year-old Christian missionary from Nebraska, of all places, ended up playing a pivotal role in that revolution. And his name was Howard Baskerville. So let me just tell you this story, and then we'll can sort of talk about the lessons that we can learn from what happened 100 years ago to what's going on today. In 1905, a group of young, zealous revolutionaries poured out onto the streets of Tehran, even then the capital of Iran, to demand a constitution that would clearly lay out the rights and privileges of all citizens in Iran, and a parliament, an elected body that would have the ability not just to create legislation, but more importantly, to curb the unchecked power of the Shah. The Shah is just the Persian word for king, the king of Iran. Iran, of course, had been a monarchy for, at that point, really thousands of years. In 1906, after a year of bloodshed and hardships, they got what they wanted. They wrote a very progressive constitution, a constitution that actually laid out the freedom of speech, the freedom of thought, the freedom of religion, and they built a parliament and had the first elections in Iran. This was, at that time, the first democratic revolution in the entire Middle East. The constitution was signed by the Shah at that time, a man by the name of Muzaffar ad-Din Shah, who signed the constitution in December of 1906, and then promptly died. And the person who took his throne was his son, his 35-year-old son, Muhammad Ali. Not that Muhammad Ali, but now you'll never forget the name. Muhammad Ali Shah, let me tell you something, okay? As an Iranian, I can say that we have had some miserable SOBs sit on the throne of Persia. But this guy took the cake. Believing that the throne was his by right, that God had given him all of Persia as his birthright, and being profoundly angry with his father for having taken these steps to curtail his divine authority, the Shah tore up the constitution and then rolled cannons to the parliament building and destroyed the building with the parliamentarians inside. They were actually in the middle of a session when this happened. He then used his Russian-trained troops, Russian-backed, Russian-trained, and Russian-funded. The Russian Empire was absolutely entrenched in Persia and completely backing the Shah. After all, the Tsar had just a year earlier barely survived his own revolution in 1905, and the last thing that he wanted to see was something like that happening on his southern border. And so he, with the help of his Russian-commanded, Russian-trained, Russian-equipped, and Russian-funded troops, the Shah took back control over the entirety of Iran, the entire country. The entire country, every city, every province, except for one, the city of Tabriz. Tabriz is a kind of a historical city at the sort of northwest corner of Iran. And this is one of those moments where I really wish that the PowerPoint would have worked and I could have showed you all these really cool images, but let's just use our imagination. The very, very northwest corner of Iran. And there is where the revolutionaries sort of all gathered and made their kind of last stand against the Shah's troops. And it was right around this time, in the sort of fall of 1907, that Howard Baskerville suddenly showed up. Howard Baskerville was the son and grandson of Presbyterian preachers. He was born in Nebraska, as I say, but raised in the Black Hills of South Dakota. In 1903, he followed in his father's footsteps and went to Princeton in order to study Christian ministry. But while he was at Princeton, he had to, because it was actually quite a new system back then, that's called the preceptorial system, that was sort of the creation of Princeton University, but has now become sort of standard across university systems. But he was forced to take electives, right? And those electives were during his junior year, and he chose to take two electives with a man who was by far the most popular professor at Princeton at the time, and indeed had just recently been named president of Princeton University, Woodrow Wilson. Now, Woodrow Wilson, complicated man, very, very complicated person, as we know. On the one hand, he basically gave birth to what we now understand to be international law. He created a global movement that resulted in not just helping to win World War I, but the creation of the League of Nations, which is the precursor to the United Nations. On the other hand, he was a despicable, unrepentant racist who was a supporter of the Confederacy, like long after the Civil War was done. I mean, the Civil War was finished and lost for decades, and he was still talking about how great the Confederacy was. This is a man who wrote glowing essays about how wonderful the KKK was and what a sort of southern institution that it was. As president of Princeton University, Woodrow Wilson refused to follow in the footsteps of all the other Ivy League schools and allow black students to enter the university. And when asked why, he said, because it would be embarrassing for them and for us. This is a man who, as president of the United States, essentially did away with the entire black workforce in D.C. He once actually screened Birth of a Nation at the White House. So when I say unrepentant racist, that's not just a judgment call. That is a demonstrable fact. And yet, he also had this view of democracy and popular sovereignty, which may sound a little familiar to us nowadays, but which was utterly unique back then, that democracy wasn't the creation of human beings. Democracy was God's gift to humankind, that all peoples everywhere the divine will was that all peoples everywhere live in a democratic society, that freedom and popular sovereignty was a universal impulse for all peoples. And he would give these incredible orations as a professor in his classes. And he was, when I say popular, I mean seven times he was voted most popular professor at Princeton. I mean, his lecture halls would have, you know, students just flowing into the hallways and out onto the sidewalks trying to listen to his orations. And Baskerville took two courses with Woodrow Wilson, a course in jurisprudence and a course in international governance. And it is no exaggeration to say that these courses absolutely changed the course of his life. And while he did finish his degree in Christian ministry, when he graduated from Princeton, rather than do what was expected of him, which was go back to South Dakota and become a country preacher just like your dad and your granddad, he decided that he wanted some grand adventure. But as a young Presbyterian kid, I mean, you know, how do you go see the world? Like, what are the options that are available to you? Well, there's really only one option. You become a missionary. And that's what he did. He applied to the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions. In his application, which I had the great pleasure, I just came from the Presbyterian Historical Society, which is just around over here. And if you haven't been to it, you should go. It's very, very cool. Very cool. And I got to see, you know, an actual physical copy of his application to become a missionary. And on that application, there's this wonderful question where he's asked, where do you want to go? Like, where do you feel, you know, you're being called? And Baskerville, on that application, but also in other letters, made it very clear that, you know, he had prayed about it, and he had really, really believes that Jesus wanted him to go to China or Japan. That's where God was calling him to the Far East. I'm sure that had nothing to do with the fact that he was reading all these glowing missionary dispatches from China and Japan talking about how great everything is and how many people are coming to Christ, and oh, Japan is so beautiful, and the Chinese are so amenable to the gospel story. Now, on that application, it says China or Japan, and then in very, very small print, just above that, he had written, almost as an afterthought, or Persia. And there was a reason he did that, because he knew that the Presbyterian Church was desperately looking for young Christian men and women to take the saving grace of Jesus to the lost sheep of the Middle East. And they weren't getting a lot of volunteers, as you can imagine. And I think Baskerville realized, okay, I really want to go to China and Japan, but if I have to, I'll go to Persia. But he did not want to go to Persia. On the contrary, the same missionary dispatches that were talking in such glowing terms about China and Japan were talking in appalling terms about Persia. Persia was being referred to as basically the worst place on earth. You know, the people are terrible. The culture is ruinous. The historical achievements are destroyed. My favorite line from a missionary, a man by the name of Justin Perkins, who, by the way, spent decades in Persia, he wrote in his report that all the sins of the Decalogue are ever present amongst the Persians, and add to those the even greater sin of Sodom. This 22-year-old kid is like reading these reports, and that's not what he was looking for. But of course, that's exactly where he gets assigned. And what are you going to do? You're a missionary. They tell you, go spread the gospel in Persia. And so that's what you do. So he goes very reluctantly to Persia, and he gets assigned to the city of Tabriz, of all places. He shows up, first of all, in the midst of a revolution, completely as a surprise, I think, to him. But he very quickly recognizes that almost everything that he had heard about Persia was wrong. He falls in love with the country. He absolutely falls in love with the people. He goes crazy for Persian food, which you can understand as a Nebraskan. I mean, yeah, he's like used to boiled potatoes, and now he's eating, if I do say so myself, the greatest cuisine in the world. And he instantly becomes the most popular teacher at this school. He's assigned a teaching position. He's going to teach English, and he's going to teach history, American history, to these Persian kids at the missionary school. It's called the American Memorial School. And his students love him, and he loves his students, and he gets to ride horses. You know, he came from South Dakota, so what he sees, Tabriz itself, not a city of great architectural wonders, but Azerbaijan, the province that Tabriz is in, is just a spectacular wilderness with massive bald mountains and huge river valleys. He boxes, he teaches tennis to the kids on the side, he gives them horse riding lessons. He is having the time of his life. But he's not there to have the time of his life. He's there to teach, and he's there to convert Muslims, to do what he himself in his letters refers to as the Muhammadan work. And it's not going very well. It's not going very, very well for a couple of reasons. One, because as a sort of the grandchild of the Second Great Awakening, so essentially the first real generation of what we would nowadays refer to as evangelical Protestantism, his conception of Christianity, or just religion in general, was completely at odds with how Persians understood religion. He was talking about Christianity as like, you know, a process of individual salvation, right? Something that is just the grace of God, that all you have to do is believe in Jesus and you shall have eternal life forever and ever. It all sounds very familiar to us, but it's quite a fairly new concept 100-something years ago. And so he's preaching this version of Christianity, and even Persia's Christians are confused by this, because that's not how religion works in Persia. Religion is what you do in Persia, not what you believe. It's not about the doctrine or theology. It's about what are you willing to actually do to put these beliefs into practice. That's the heart of Shi'ism, but it's also the heart of Baha'ism, which was another major religion in Persia. And it was definitely the heart of the indigenous Christianity in Persia, the so-called Armenian or Assyrian or Chaldean or Nestorian, these kind of indigenous Middle Eastern Christianities that many of them trace their roots back to the apostles themselves. And here's this kind of, you know, 22-year-old white kid showing up and saying, yeah, you're not really doing it right. Let me show you how it's done. And, you know, I've read everything that I can find about Baskerville and about his time, and I can tell you that as far as I can tell, I don't think he ever converted anybody. He was not a successful missionary at all. Meanwhile, as he's teaching these classes Many of his history classes were about American history, so he's talking about, you know, the Revolutionary War and how the America as we know it comes to fruition. There's literally a Revolutionary War taking place on the other side of the school. I'm just outside his window. He's talking in theory about a literal thing that's happening. I mean, his students had older siblings and fathers who were not just fighting in that revolution, but many of whom were dying in that revolution. And this just starts to, as you can imagine, weigh heavily on Baskerville. He feels like a hypocrite, because he is a hypocrite. However, he is constantly being told, first by the school, then by the mission that sent him there, the Presbyterian Board of Missions, and finally by the U.S. State Department, that whatever is happening in Tabriz is none of his business. It's not his business. The school says, you're here to teach. That's not your job. You focus on your teaching. The Presbyterian Mission Board says, you're here to save souls, not lives. Okay? Obviously, you can sympathize with the revolutionaries. You can, you know, heal them. You can help feed them. You can do all those things. And by the way, I just want to make it very clear that his fellow missionaries all did sympathize with the revolutionaries. They were on their side. The letters that they wrote back home very clearly makes it very clear where they stood, right? At least spiritually, where they stood. They saw the Shah as the villain in this story and the revolutionaries as the hero of this story. Nevertheless, it's not their job. Their job is to save souls, not lives. Focus on that. And then ultimately, he's also warned by the American government, which, despite the fact that the United States had no real role or influence in Iran at the time, that would come 50 years later. In fact, the United States didn't have any real kind of presence anywhere in the Middle East at that time. It hadn't thought about the Middle East. Nevertheless, the internal State Department memos made it very clear that whatever is happening in Persia was absurd, because there can be no such thing as a democracy in a Muslim country. That's just dumb. That doesn't happen. Islam, quote, Islam seems to imply autocracy, the State Department memo said. And so the entire mission was warned repeatedly by the State Department, this is none of your business. We cannot have anything to do with what's happening there, so mind your own business. And so Baskerville does. He puts his head down, teaches his classes, preaches the gospel when he can, continues to ride horses and have a great time, but is, you know, adamant about obeying these instructions that he is getting. And then something happens in 1909, and I'm obviously speeding through this history, but in 1909, the Shah's troops finally make their way to Tabriz, and they try for many, many, many weeks in order to take Tabriz by force, but it's not working. And it's not working primarily because of the fact that the revolutionaries are now being buttressed by Russians and Georgians and Armenians and Turks. It's becoming truly this kind of global movement. It was, at the time, the most successful anti-imperialist movement that existed in that part of the world, and it really drew the attention of other revolutionaries across the world who came to Tabriz to fight alongside these Persians against the Shah for the freedom of the Iranian people. And so the Shah, after some time of trying to take the town militarily, changes course and decides, okay, if I can't defeat you, then I'm just going to draw a circle around you and then starve you to death. And that's exactly what he does. He besieges the city, cuts off all food, cuts off all water. And what follows is one of these important pivotal moments in Iranian history. It's one of the sort of, I mean, every school kid in every school in Iran is taught about the siege of Tabriz because it was a horrific humanitarian disaster. People by the hundreds dying on the streets, women, children, babies, men, you know, who were boiling their shoes in order to try to eat anything. And in the midst of this disaster, in the midst of, you know, watching these people that he's lived with for, you know, almost a year and a half just dying before his eyes, I think Baskerville just snaps and he just can't take it anymore. And he goes to his class, he stands before his students, and he says to them, I cannot just sit by any longer and watch the suffering that's taking place in the streets. The only way that I know how to help you, my own students, is to quit this job and go join the revolution. And in a moment that is like perfectly made for Hollywood, his students stand up and join him. And they leave the school and they go right into the battlefield. Well, as you can imagine, the U.S. State Department freaks out. Can't have an American fighting in a foreign war. The consul general at the time, a man by the name of William Doty, goes to Howard Baskerville in the midst of a training regiment that they're doing in preparing for a battle, and he says to Baskerville in no uncertain terms, "These are not your people. This is not your fight. This is not your country. You have to desist from these revolutionary activities." And Howard Baskerville sweeps his eyes across the battlefield and says the sentence for which he is most famous for 115 years later, which is that the only difference between me and these people is the place of my birth, and that is not a big difference. He is threatened with actual treason, believe it or not. The American government uses the word treason in its threats to Howard Baskerville. And so Baskerville hands over his passport and says, then I guess I'm not under American protection any longer. He gives up his American citizenship at that moment. The State Department doesn't know what to do now. Okay, well, now we can't control this kid. He's not one of ours anymore. He voluntarily gave up his American identity, so we can't control him. We can't arrest him. We can't do anything. Let's get the Presbyterians to do something about this. I mean, they sent him here. They must have some kind of control over him. So the Assistant Secretary of State sends an urgent memo to Robert Speer, who is at that time the head of the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions. And to just sort of paraphrase that memo, he says, come get your boy. Do you know what he's doing? One of your missionaries has joined a revolution. Come and get him. He's your responsibility. This, of course, is an existential crisis for the Presbyterian Church. They can't have their missionaries every once in a while rise up against the governments in the countries in which they are serving. That's the death of the entire Presbyterian mission enterprise if that happens. And so the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions sends an absolutely baffling response to the State Department. And the response is, Howard Baskerville is not one of our missionaries. Technically, he's a teacher at our missionary school. We have nothing to do with his actions. We disavow them, and we bear no responsibility for it. I actually have the internal State Department communiques that were going back and forth in response to that memo from the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions. And the response is dumbfounded. They're like, what do you mean? He's not a missionary, but he's a teacher at a missionary school, but you paid for him to come here in order to preach the gospel, but he's not one of yours. They don't understand it any more than you guys do. It is simply an attempt to wash their hands of this entire affair, which you can understand why that is. And now Baskerville is on his own. He has quit his teaching job. He has abandoned his missionary position, and he has given up his American protection. And so he has joined this revolution headlong. Just to fast forward a little bit, by the middle of April, there's no more food in Tabriz. The population is on the brink of mass starvation. There's a New York Times article written about the horror that says it's possible that perhaps tens of thousands will die in the coming weeks from this mass starvation. And so there's no more choice. Somebody has to break through the siege and try to go get help, try to go get food. And Baskerville volunteers himself and his students who had formed this militia in order to do that. And on the morning of April 20th, that's what they try to do. It doesn't last very long. Baskerville gets shot in the heart very early in the attempt. But his death and the mass starvation in Tabriz becomes such an international embarrassment that the Russians and the British eventually force the Shah to declare a ceasefire and to allow food and medical supplies into Tabriz. And the revolutionaries take that moment to march on Tehran, to bring down the Shah, send him into exile, recreate the constitution, rebuild the parliament. And the first act of the new parliament, the first legislative act of the new parliament, is to declare this kid, this missionary kid from Nebraska, to be a hero and a martyr in the cause of freedom for Iran. His tomb is still in the city of Tabriz. There is a museum in Tabriz where there is a giant golden bust of Howard Baskerville and a painting of him, along with some sort of historical artifacts connected to him and to the revolution. And for decades and decades and decades, people from all over Iran would travel to Tabriz to honor this American who gave his life for Iran. When I was a kid growing up in Iran, there were schools and streets named after Howard Baskerville. But of course, since the 1979 revolution, more or less all trace of Howard Baskerville has been erased from the public memory. It's very difficult to find anyone, certainly anyone under the age of 50 in Iran, who still knows who Howard Baskerville is. Although I was just recently told by a friend of mine in Tehran that there's a very popular chain of coffee shops called Baskerville that's mostly attended by the Gen Z, the young people. And I'm almost positive that all those kids who are like sipping lattes at the Baskerville coffee shops have no idea who Howard Baskerville is. And that's one thing, that's a tragedy that he's been forgotten in Iran. But I think an even worse tragedy is that he was never remembered in America to begin with, that his story never became known. And why that is, it's hard to say. Certainly the American government and the Presbyterian Church had a vested interest to make sure that this story did not get a lot of attention. The day after Baskerville died, the American legate in Tehran, which is sort of the sort of precursor to an ambassador, right? When you don't have an official embassy, you have a legate. So technically the ambassador, if you will, wrote a memo to the State Department in which he says very clearly, Baskerville's death seems to have simplified matters somewhat, as in, great, we don't have to deal with this anymore, we don't have to talk about it anymore. And that's what's happened. I've always known this story. I mean, people ask me all the time, like, how did you first hear it? I don't know. I just kind of grew up knowing who Howard Baskerville was. It's a product of my generation, but also I've been told maybe my socioeconomic status in Iran. that this is a person that I would have been taught about in school. But I feel as though I've been kind of called, if you will, in the same way that Baskerville would have used that word, in order to make sure that his name is resurrected, not just in Iran, but also here in the United States. Because he represents so much that's important about this moment right now, not just the fact that we are now watching Iranians on the streets dying for the exact same rights that Baskerville died defending 100 years ago, which is its own depressing thing. Just put that aside for a minute. But I also think that Baskerville reminds us as Americans of the responsibility that we have, that the rights that we take for granted are rights that are universal, and that the suffering of people in other parts of the world, the clamoring for those basic rights, those basic human rights, are in a way our responsibility. Obviously, we can't pick up a rifle and go join in those revolutions. Don't do that. But we have something perhaps even more powerful than a rifle. We have our voices. We have the ability to raise our voices and to elevate the voices of people around the world, but especially now in Iran, who are asking for, as I say, nothing big, just the ability to think and say and love whoever and whatever they want. We take that for granted, but we have to remember that that also burdens us with a responsibility to make sure that those freedoms are freedoms that everybody else gets as well. So thank you. I'll just stop there. And I think we have time for a Q&A. And there's a microphone that's going around. And I'd be happy to talk about the book and the story. And also happy to answer any questions you may have about the current crisis in Iran right now.
How is this book received in Iran? Is it even allowed to be there?
Well, so, you know, Iran doesn't abide by any copyright laws at all. Every book I have ever written has been translated and published in Iran without my permission or say-so, which I don't mind at all. I love it. In a couple of my previous books, I actually had them translated into Persian and then put the PDFs online so that anyone in Iran can do it for free. That's in the process of happening right now. I have an institute in Salt Lake City that is now putting a Persian translation of this book. And when it's done, we will put it online and make it free to anyone from Iran who wants to download it. That said, I'm certain that some enterprising publishing house in Iran is just going to translate it and publish it anyway. But I want to make sure that it's free, and I want to make sure everyone has access to it.
Great story. Thank you for coming out tonight. A couple questions. One, how hard was it hard to find information on Baskerville for you to put this book together? You could talk a little bit about your process of assembling the sources for this.
Yes, it was extraordinarily difficult. The basic outline of Baskerville's story has been around for a very, very long time. And every once in a while, some, you know, academic or some just kind of, you know, fan of Iranian history will write a brief article or something online. But it's always the exact same story. Kid from Nebraska, went to Iran, fought in the revolution, died, considered a martyr and a hero. And that's all I basically knew, too. That barely makes a pamphlet, you know? So when I decided to write this book, I was very nervous. I really thought to myself, oh, my, is this like a 12-page book? Is that what I'm about to write? But I absolutely scored because, as I just said a little while ago, even though it was in the middle of COVID and I couldn't physically go anywhere or do anything, the Presbyterian Historical Society had digitized hundreds and hundreds of documents about not just Baskerville, but about the West Persia Mission and the American Memorial School. So that was just a treasure trove. I also found some documents in the Princeton Historical Archives. You know, there was a time where Princeton actually celebrated Howard Baskerville, though they too seem to have forgotten, you know, about this hero graduate of theirs. And then, in sort of one of those kind of lucky accidents, I hired a research assistant who turned out to be the greatest research assistant in the history of the world, and he found documents in Russian and in Persian. He found unpublished diaries of missionaries who were there at the time. You know, he found letters. I mean, this guy, I honestly don't know how he did it, but he was an absolute lifesaver. And so suddenly I was able to form a three-dimensional human being, right? Someone with a past, somebody that I could actually recognize. And then at that point, it was really just a matter of putting that person in his time and place. And this was a pretty extraordinary and dramatic time and place. And so that process allowed for a real sort of substantial biography to form, one that also answered a lot of questions about his motivations. You know, as you can imagine, it's been a century of theorizing about why in the world would Baskerville do something like this. And even at the time, there was a lot of kind of misinformation about his motivations. When he abandoned his American citizenship, there was a lot of misinformation about, wait a minute, has he become a Persian? Is that what he's doing? You know, he's changing his citizenship. When he abandoned his mission, there was actually some grumblings about perhaps he had converted to Islam. Oh my goodness, this kid was coming here to convert Muslims to Christianity, and it turned out they converted him to Islam. But I have the letters. I had the letters that he wrote not just to the consul general explaining his actions, but the letter that he wrote a few days before his death to his mother back in South Dakota, a letter that he could not send because of the blockade, a letter that was found folded in his shirt pocket next to the bullet hole when he was brought back to Tabriz from the battlefield. And in that letter, and in both those letters, Baskerville makes it very clear that he is not abandoned his missionary duties. This was his missionary duties. It's just that rather than continue to talk about what Jesus would do, he's just going to go do what Jesus would do. And indeed, the head of the school, a man by the name of Samuel Wilson, writes a letter to Robert Speer after Baskerville's death, deliberately trying to clear up any kind of misinformation that Robert Speer has been hearing. He says in no uncertain terms that Baskerville did this as a spiritual exercise, and that action has actually done more to sort of spread the gospel message amongst the Persians than anything that he had said or anything any one of them had said before. And most crucially, in that letter to the American consul general in Tabriz, Baskerville makes it absolutely clear that he's not giving up his American identity, he's exerting his American identity, that this is what it means to be an American, this is what it means to be a Christian. And so that was a very important find, because I think that put to rest any of the debates and arguments that had been out there for a while about why this 20-something-year-old white Christian kid from Nebraska would have done what he did. And it turns out that the answer is the simplest answer, because he thought it was the right thing to do. It's not complicated, because he thought this was the right thing to do.
Your work in bringing all of this to our attention, I wonder, when your work is translated in Persia, is it censored? Do people blackline things?
You know, I don't know. That's actually, you mean when it's officially?
Well,
in my version, no. In my version, right, it'll just be a PDF that anyone can have. But I actually have never really thought about this because I don't have access to those books. I'm going to definitely assume that they are censored. Yeah, I think about My first book, No God But God, is available in Persian bookstores, and there's no way that there are... there are certain sections in that book that I can think of right now that there's no way that they weren't censored. And I think same with Zealot, my book about Jesus, right, which is also available in Persian. I'm certain there are elements of that. But again, I don't know because I don't see them.
My first question, though, was really, what happened to Baskerville's his students that formed their own unit? Did any of them survive the revolution to write about it or talk about it?
Yes, many of them did survive. In fact, one of them, his sort of pet, like his favorite student, the student that kind of was the first student that he met at this school, and the student who was by his side when he was shot. His name is Sadek Rezazadeh Shafak. He actually became quite a prominent a person in Iranian history. He was part of the first delegation, Iran's first delegation to the United Nations. He has to flee after the revolution. He ends up getting a PhD in philosophy. He becomes a diplomat and a member of the Persian Senate later on. And then in 1959, on the 50th anniversary of Baskerville's death, and I would have had the video, I could have showed you if this worked, there is a big celebration in Tabriz where a group of American diplomats and their Iranian counterparts meet at Baskerville's gravesite, lay flowers, and then have this big banquet in which they talk about Baskerville being the bond that brings America and Iran together. And at that ceremony, Sadek gave this very long speech, this very long talk, in which he basically talks about, you know, when he first met Baskerville and what the classes with him were like, and you know what happened, and some of the quotations, and then he gives a brief account of his death. That short little pamphlet, which also exists in the Presbyterian Historical Society, yet another reason to go and visit this jewel inside your city. It's like a 25-page little pamphlet was published, and it's in English, and it's available to anyone. And that was 1959, so for, you know, whatever, 70 years, that was the only quote-unquote biography of Howard Baskerville. And I did employ it. I used a lot of it. He gets a few things wrong, That was basically it. Okay, one more question. How about two more questions, and I promise I'll be brief.
Two questions. First...
Okay, three questions.
are you welcome in Iran? Could you travel
there?
Oh,
God, no. No, okay. No.
Just checking it out.
No, I would never be heard from again if I went back to Iran.
And the second question is, do you have any speculation about the outcome of the current unrest in Iran?
I had a lot of speculation.
Third revelation, and to the extent you'd be willing to share it, we'd love to hear.
It's very hard. It's very hard to say. Here's what I will say, is that what we call the 1979 revolution started in 1977. We are 1 month into this uprising. We have a long way to go. And it's hard to know what the next... you know, spark will be. It's hard to know. Maybe Khamenei will suddenly die in the next, few weeks or whatever. He is a very, very old, very sick man who had cancer. It went away and it's back. And so maybe there's suddenly a succession, you know, drama in the midst of a revolution. Maybe the military will step in. We're starting to see the slightest bit of cracks amongst the military hierarchy about how to respond to what's happening. You know, to be clear, the response so far has been atrocious and bloodshed and merciless. That's what the response has been. But it's not doing anything. It's not working. In fact, if anything, it's bringing more people out onto the streets. Is it possible that the military might step in and sort of declare martial law and send the mullahs back to the mosque? It's possible. it's hard to know. What I will say is that I lived through a revolution, and I've been watching and studying Iran for the last 40 years. I've never seen anything like this before. I've never seen anything like this. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Does Baskerville's family try to convince him not to fight, and how does he respond? And when he's going to fight, is he anticipating that he's going to die or emerge successfully? And if he thinks he's going to die, are there any records of him writing what he thinks about his imminent death?
Yeah, this is one of those moments where I had to do whatever I could to take the material that I had at hand and sort of create a character that whose motivations and whose actions make sense. And in the letter that he writes to his mother right before he dies, for months they've been under siege, so no mail is going in or out at all. All the mail is being confiscated by the Shah's troops, so he doesn't hear anything from his mother. But he does write this letter to his mother and to his brothers before he dies. And in that letter, he says, it actually starts in just the most heartbreakingly adorable way. It starts with, "By now you may have heard..." and he says, you know, "Yeah, it's true. I have left my job and my mission, and I've joined these revolutionaries, but don't worry about it. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. We're going to win this thing." And it's hard to know whether he's lying or not, because it was at that moment an unwinnable conflict. The idea that they could have broken through this siege of thousands of heavily armed troops. In fact, I write in the book that the troops were given a brand new French-made weapon. It was the first time this weapon had shown up in Iran, and it's called the Maxim gun. It was sort of the first machine gun. It allowed you to fire 60 bullets at a go. And that's what he was facing. So there's a moment that, you know, there is written about by the wife of the headmaster at the school that he teaches, a woman by the name of Annie Wilson, who sees Baskerville on the eve before this mission and who says that, you know, he seemed confident. You know, he was gaunt and he looked tired and he was clearly hungry. But he seemed confident, is the words that she uses. I can't believe that to be true. It was him and 11 teenagers, you know? So to this question of, did he know that he was sacrificing himself or not? I don't have the definitive answer to that, but what I can say is, it's hard to imagine that he didn't know that. It's hard to imagine that he thought that this was going to work. And indeed, as I say, it didn't last very long at all. They didn't get even close to breaking the siege before he was shot in the heart. Which, and this is the important thing, which made that action that much more valuable to the Iranians, to the Persian people, because the notion of self-sacrifice, the idea of dying for a belief that you have, being willing to die for it, is at the heart of Persian Shiism. And so when they refer to Baskerville as a martyr, they mean it in the sort of the Shia sense of that. Here's this kid, this Christian kid, who did this act that we're all very familiar with. And it was very easy in that sense, as I say, to kind of integrate him into the sort of larger notion of spirituality and self-sacrifice in Iran and amongst Persians. Thank you very much, you all. I'm delighted to sign books and carry on this conversation outside. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.